Pellicle is proudly sponsored by Loughran Brewers Select, a seventh generation family-owned business based near Dundalk in Ireland. In 2014, James Loughran established Loughran Brewing Stores in order to supply high-quality brewing ingredients to the burgeoning beer industries in the UK, Ireland and mainland Europe. The business expanded in 2022 when ingredient wholesaler Brewers Select joined the Loughran family, expanding its suppliers within the brewing ingredient and raw material industry. Some of those suppliers include Crosby Hops, a family-owned hop farm in Oregon, USA, Baird's Malt here in the UK, and industry-leading yeast producer Lallemand. Thanks to their support, we're able to pay more writers, photographers, and illustrators than ever before, and invest in special projects like this podcast. Thanks again to Loughran Brewers Select, who you can find out more about by visiting brewersselect.co.uk/pellicle. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome back to the Pellicle Podcast with me, Matthew Curtis, and to another of the discussions we recorded at IndieMan BeerCon, the Independent Manchester Beer Convention last year. You may have already listened to our interview with the beer writer David Jesudarson talking about his book Desi Pubs, and we have three more panel discussions we recorded at the event, including this one, which we called An Open Discussion on Sustainability in Beer. I bring this to you with a bit of a bittersweet air to it, because before we had a chance to get these out, a couple of weeks ago, the folks at IndieMan released an announcement to say there wouldn't be a festival in 2024. But the nature of it felt like a winding down. Maybe we'll see it reappear again in the future, but for now, there's no IndieMan or guarantee of IndieMan BeerCon. So before we talk a bit about the actual discussion we've got for you today, I just want to take a moment to reflect, or as I like to say, check in with my feelings about there not being an IndieMan. And I'm going to be brief because I could share memories. I think I went to about 7 or 8 of the festivals over its 12-year run. It ran 10 events because obviously there weren't any events in the 2 years we had the COVID lockdowns. And there were highs and lows. I did one of my first ever talks there as a beer blogger back in the day. But when I thought about it, the thing that I cherish most about IndieMan and the fact it existed is that during those festivals, I met a certain group of people based here in Manchester who love beer. And if you're listening, you know if you're one of these people. They came up to me and went, "Oh, are you the beer blogger Matt Curtis?" back in the day, before this was my living, and planted a little seed. And over the years, we'd become friends. And eventually, I would choose to move to this wonderful city of Manchester and make my permanent home here. And this group of people who love beer and pubs as much as I do have adopted me into their group as much as Manchester has adopted me as my home city. And they made me feel so welcome, and it's such a pleasure to be a part of that group. Without IndieMan, I wouldn't have it. So thank you, IndieMan, for introducing me to some of my wonderful friends. And I think it's that expression that shows how important a festival it was. Yes, it showcased amazing beer, breweries from all over the world. The venue, the Victoria Baths, made it such a wonderful place to have a beer, to party into the evening, to have a more considered approach and try lots of things in the day sessions. But to make those connections, I can't imagine that happening anywhere else. And that's perhaps why it's the best example of a modern beer festival I can think of, and why so many people have attempted to copy it, but no one's quite managed to reach that same level, that feeling, that buzz you get when you're inside the baths, standing in an empty swimming pool, drinking some mad IPA or pastry stout from a brewery that's just experimenting, having fun. I hope those days haven't gone forever, because they are very special. Things have changed now. What I want and what my group of friends want has changed. We want to sit in the pub and drink pints of bitter and mild and drink lots of Guinness, whereas before we wanted to try everything new. We've got older. Things are changing. That's something I really need to sit down and reflect on in a future episode. But for now, we're going to talk about sustainability. And we've got a great panel. It's hosted by my Pellicle co-founder, Johnny Hamilton, kind of with his head brewer at New Barns Brewery in Edinburgh hat on. And it's one of the last things he did for us before he decided to take his little hiatus from Pellicle. So it's really been nice for me to hear his voice. And his guests include Johnny Hayes, who's actually one of the founders of Indie Man BeerCon. And he, along with his wife, Charlotte, owns a group of bars in Manchester, collectively referred to as Common & Co., one of which is Common in the Northern Quarter, another is the amazing Port Street Beer House. They also own The Beagle down in Chorlton, and their most recent venture is Nell's Pizza, and it feels like that's where they're going into this world of pizza, and it is some of the best pizza in Manchester. So you can see that where the festival was such an important thing for them at one point, maybe they'll come back with a pizza festival. I wouldn't complain about a pizza and beer festival. Any excuse to eat delicious pizza. But it's nice to have Johnny on this panel, not just because he's the founder of IMBC, but because he brings that perspective of beer and hospitality into quite a brewer-heavy discussion. And it helps you kind of reflect on the fact that for beer to be truly sustainable, it has to be right the way down the supply chain. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. It can't be. Johnny and Johnny are joined by Ben Stubbs, who's one of the co-founders and brewers at Rivington Brewery in Lancashire, not too far away from Manchester. And they have an absolutely gorgeous tap room that I insist you make the time to visit. It really is a special space. And Chris Drummond from Allkin Brewing. Now, we featured Chris's previous brewery, Good Things, in an article written by Emma Inch a couple of years ago. And not long after that article was published, there was a bit of a tragedy where their brewery, which was in a 17th century barn, was struck by lightning and it burnt down and damaged the brewery. But they have risen like a phoenix from the flames, literally, to become Allkin Brewing. And they seem to have a bright future ahead of them. And they are very invested in sustainability. At Indie Man itself, they even had two massive solar-powered batteries that they were running their Linde keg taps with, which was really interesting to see. I'm not sure how much that will offset the overall carbon footprint of a beer festival, but it was really interesting to see a brewery finding a way not to use mains electricity to power their festival setup. Like I said, there's lots of very brewery-heavy discussion from the three brewers, with discussion focusing around water usage, importing ingredients from all over the world, the fact that brewing is basically heating stuff up and cooling it down repeatedly. It is a very energy intensive business. We also talk about shipping beer around the world, which at this year's Indie Man, there was no air freighted beer as they tried to be a little bit more sustainable. So there's lots of interesting perspectives. I think I've said just about enough though, and the best thing to do now is to head straight into this discussion, an open discussion about sustainability in beer.
Okay, my name is Johnny Hamilton, co-founder of Pellicle Mag with Matt, but I also am a co-founder of a brewery based in Edinburgh called New Barns. So yeah, I'm coming at this from a perspective of being in both sides of the industry. So as someone who both produces and writes and puts out content about beer. So I'm just going to get the panel to introduce themselves and where they work and what their job title is.
Yeah, hi, I'm Chris Drummond. I'm from Allkin Brewing Company, formerly Good Things Brewing Co. Good Things is a kind of fully off-grid, self-sustained in all its kind of own energy brewery. That sadly got struck by lightning 2 years ago and burnt to the ground. So we're now rebuilding kind of as a new brewery, new and improved team. I've got to say that because half of them are here. No, all of them are here. So my background all comes from sustainable engineering. So it's very much from the kind of production side out. And now as a team looking to progress that into distribution and then supply chain and so on.
Hi, I'm Ben. I'm the owner founder of Rivington Brewing Co., a little farm brewery based not too far away from here. My background is nothing like that. My background was in sales, dealing with massive supermarkets and very unsustainable. So, but seeing a lot of the side of big business that I didn't like, which gave me a lot of food for thought when sort of setting up Rivington and going forward to Rivington.
I'm Johnny Hayes. I'm founder of IBC. And yeah, thank you all for coming to this, our 10th event over 12 years, with a couple of years out for that blip. But yeah, really happy to be here with Pellicle today, chatting about sustainability.
Perfect. Yeah, so it's obviously a huge topic to get into. We've only got 40 minutes, but then some questions. So we're going to see where this goes, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about. But to start, I just want to talk about how beer is made and the kind of some things that people don't realize. Because when we talk about wine or we talk about cider, everything is usually made on site. Whereas with brewing, we're often buying ingredients from many, many places and using an incredible amount of water. And I don't think people who drink beer maybe appreciate that, how much water goes into making every pint of beer. And I think now we're getting to the stage in the industry where, you know, the craft sector is, you know, booming, and everyone's starting to kind of look at how not only to make good beer, but how to make good beer in a sustainable way that's good for the planet and means that we can keep making beer going forward. So we've got two breweries here who are based in kind of more, yeah, as you said, off-grid and on farms. And I was wondering if we could talk to Ben about Rivington and how important agriculture and keeping things in a kind of small radius of and how that works for you guys.
Yeah, for sure. So we're in the unique position that we're still actually a working farm as well. We're working, used to be a working dairy farm, it's now a working beef farm. Part of the reason that, well, my co-founder is still the farmer, or the farming side of it, part of the reason we actually built the brewery and scaled the brewery to where it is that we wanted to decrease the farming side, particularly the sort of some of the stress on the land, the animal welfare conditions as well, even though it's sort of a beef farm. Basically, Mick was a sort of precipice where either he looks to have a huge herd of sort of 400-500 cattle, which is not great in terms of sort of animal conditions, animal welfare, a lot of stress on the land in terms of what you're doing. So we were sort of brewing together and started the brewery. Now, as the brewery's got bigger, it's allowed him to sort of like really decrease the herd. We've made steps, including now there's no fertilizer whatsoever used on any of the land around the farm. Instead, what we're using is, you know, some of the byproducts, particularly hops that we're using in the farm as well. It's allowed us to sort of downgrade the herd to roughly about 80 at the moment as well, which sort of is a sort of nice little manageable size. I appreciate if anyone that's vegan here might not be the easiest chap, but it allows the cows sort of have a longer life as well. We don't have to sort of get them to market really quickly to sort of pay bills. In essence, the brewery funds the vast majority of sort of what the farm in terms of rent, in terms of everything else. So yeah, we're in a position where the grain goes straight to the cattle, straight out the mash tun, and literally sort of walk around in wheelbarrows about 20 metres, then straight to the cattle who are out sort of grazing the land. The hops go straight to the midden, so then they get spread onto the field, and hops are pretty high in nitrogen, which is one of the sort of things in fertiliser that's really key to allow the grass to grow and stuff as well. So we're now re-spreading quite a lot of our hops back onto the field as well to sort of aid with grass growth and stuff. Water's an issue for us. I mean, a lot of our water is recaptured again in the midden and sort of sprayed back onto the fields. I don't know how much of a difference it makes for us, because we're in the wettest places in the country and we're right by a reservoir, so we get a lot of rain anyway. But yeah, we're trying to look at practices that we can do to basically improve our footprint. We're also in a position that we're on a 270-year-old farm as well. So there are sort of logistical issues around that, but in essence we're looking at what we can do with the land that we have. We're looking at hedgerow planting, tree planting to offset our carbon footprint. We're looking at ways of the customers it brings to the tap room, how we can reduce that, and working with the local council around Rivington with sort of free buses and things like that as well. So we're trying.
Amazing. Yeah, I think one of the most amazing things about being able to set up a new brewery like you guys are doing is there is, looking at it, you can start putting those things in place from day one or day zero. Our brewery, for example, is very old, and in some ways you could look at it and go, like, we're using a 1970s bit of brew kit. We're saved that brew kit from going to scrap. However, I'm sure there are many new brew kits on the scene that we could have done that would help us save water and things like that. I was wondering if you have any experience with, obviously coming from your background in sustainability and engineering, how much of that went into your planning for this brewery for Alkin?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest point there that you said for me is it's really difficult if you've got an existing building, existing farm, and especially if you're brewing. Once the brewing process starts, stopping that process is just, well, you can't do it, or unless there's kind of big money bags behind that you can pause a whole production process. So in some ways, kind of post losing one brewery, there's lots of silver linings to that. And you're right, it's a way easier time now for us to push further on what we did the first time round. And just the infrastructure in itself is very destructive, and you do need everything out of the way. The first time round, we put solar panels in a field, and that works. They couldn't have gone on the roof. The roof wasn't strong enough. The roof was actually the better place. The field is actually cut and tucked down and out the way. This time round, we can bring those panels onto the roof. And just everything from the water delivery, it was going across old pipe work in the farm originally. We put a borehole in. Still, it's hard to then take up the infrastructure you have to try and get that borehole feed into the brewery and so on and so forth. It's made a huge difference for us. And then I don't want to use the word lucky, fire burnt down brewery, but it kind of feels like that now for us as we get to kind of restart from scratch. My background, kind of from an engineering point of view, this is like the perfect blank canvas. You get to kind of dream up everything at such a lower cost. Even just from our last building, kind of the struggles of getting the kit in we needed for the brewery was enough, let alone adding further and further kit to treat the water you're boring and kind of look after that process. We ran out of space within 5 minutes of opening, and kind of a story that a lot of breweries have, kind of that we know.
It's one of the hardest things with the scale of business as well. I think if you're a big business, an investment of 50-100 grand to do something is a drop in the ocean. I mean, we don't have any investors. We've self-funded it. So, like, the solar panel move we're going to make is a big chunk of money for us, yeah. Which we want to have a contingency to look after staff, to make upgrades to the brewery and stuff. So one of the things I'm sort of, again, I don't know from your background, finding is it's tough for small businesses who don't want to grow and be really big to be able to afford to put a lot of these sort of practices into place straight away.
Yeah, I'd love to create, because of my background, it's sort of they have connections from like a supplier side of like green energy, sourcing of whether it's, solar panels. Our solar panels were, we have 198 solar panels that we got for 15 grand, all through a company that is just searching for companies shutting down. They've got solar on their roofs or whatever, so they're going in and kind of a bit of a, stop the losses where they can, but they're picking up panels really cheap. I think there's a myth or whatever it may be, but a phrase always goes around, old solar panels kind of, they're 10 years in, they're useless. I mean, we can vouch for that they're not. Our panels are 8 years old and they're still hitting kind of 85-90%. And if you're paying 15 grand instead of £90,000, what they probably should have cost, before you've even got kind of to any of the installation costs and so on and so forth, then that's a huge difference. And then in kind of when we talk about sustainability as well, there's sustainability is in the planet, but then there's also the business needs to stay alive to be able to have any effect anyway. So if you've got to chuck in 150 grand on an install, it's putting the business at such pressure that it's almost a bit of a halt from day one.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, people always talk about sustainability in terms of the environment, which is obviously a huge point, but you can't be sustainability. The business needs to be stable as well. We can start talking more about the whole brewing process a bit more in detail, but I want to bring Johnny into the equation because, you know, you're also here. But once the beer is made, the impact on the environment doesn't stop. But when the last time I was here about 8 years ago at Indie Man, and it was very different because of the scene was different. So in Edinburgh, where I was based, we were used to seeing beers on tap from breweries from all around the country. And, you know, a beer list in Edinburgh at the time would probably have very little from Edinburgh, but it would probably have your likes of Magic Rock and Beavertown and the Colonel. Now, when I go to a pub nowadays, it's changed so that most of the breweries on tap are from the local area. And that's obviously changed here as well with the way in which Indie Man have approached the beer list this year. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the decision-making as to why you've scaled back from breweries outside the UK and how people received that and how you guys took that on the chin.
In 2019, I think we had between 6 and 8 international breweries. We don't necessarily need to name names, but they're very particular about the way in which they will allow their beer to be transported outside of the country. They're very obsessed about freshness and stuff, which is totally fine. There's no criticism of that. But they put a requirement on the fact that beer should be air freighted. And then, you know, if you think about a 30-litre keg, that's 30-odd kilograms. If you're shipping, you know, 20, 30 of those, even more, that's a huge amount of additional air freight. That's a huge amount of weight to be flying around the world, and it has a massive carbon impact. And that started to make me personally just feel a little bit queasy to a certain extent. So I think that was the first and most obvious thing that we did. We sort of said after that 2019, and then, you know, obviously the pandemic came along. We got more and more interested in sustainability during that period. We did carbon literacy qualifications and all this kind of stuff. And that was just, it's the easiest one to sort of say, oh, well, we won't do that. But in the terms of the impact on some of our customers, that's a much more difficult square to circle. I think that... It kind of worked, though, to a certain extent, because we were chatting just before we got started about the fact it allowed us to sort of reflect what was really going on in the UK brewing scene. Because when we first started Indie Man, we started as an outlet for breweries that weren't breweries in the UK that weren't represented at other beer festivals. That was the whole premise. So it was about supporting UK breweries. And as we went on and the scene progressed and stuff, you know, we wanted to bring in that sort of international element to sort of have a bit of a, hey, look what else is going on in the world. Like, because we knew that that's what a lot of the UK breweries were striving for, was to be able to hold up their beers against these guys like Other Half and The Vale and everybody else. And I think for us anyway, it got to the point where we were actually, where is the line? There isn't as much of a line anymore. You know, there's a rarity and a inaccessibility about some of those American beers. But I would say now that beers made in the UK are just as good a quality and just as interesting and diverse. So
I think you're bang on with that. I think you look the quality of the industry as a whole. I look at when we were 9 this December. The beers we put out our first couple of years were atrocious. Mm. Like, there's no way we'd have been here, sort of thing. And I think as the industry's matured, there's the experience in the industry as well. You look at, and obviously, Magic Rock, the amount of brewers who worked at Magic Rock who now work for breweries in Manchester. Like, Beavertown, the amount of guys who work for Beavertown now work for the breweries. It's brought this whole level of experience and quality. And even as a small brewery starting now, you have to be really good to be noticed, even like a local area. And that wasn't there before. It was, you know, I think you could put out pretty mediocre stuff. And so actually when some of the really good American stuff came over, people were like, yes, head and shoulders above what the UK's doing. But now the whole standard's lifted. I mean, their industry is, what, 20 years older than ours?
Yeah.
So the longer we go, the more the quality in the UK industry should continue to increase anyway.
Just to chime in there, because one of the, yeah, as you said, the quality of brewing has increased hugely. One of my ex-colleagues at Beavertown at the time, Chris Lewington, has now gone on to become a great advocate for sustainability and has launched his own like kind of consulting firm where he works with breweries called Brew Resourcing, and he's working with breweries to see how we can improve our sustainability. And one of those things is a company called, I need to look at my hands, Zaviro, which is a company that give you, you may have seen it on the back of cans from people like Daya, I think Northern Monk, and a few others, Gypsy Hill as well, a little thing on the back saying how many grams of carbon and CO2 were used to make that specific can. And that service is still relatively new, but I think with you guys doing the work, and you said that people might have been annoyed about the lack of international breweries, but I think they'll leave here and go like, oh yeah, we don't need to bring in those things. And the same with breweries who are very cool, like Daya. Those people saying on the back of their cans, like, hey, we care about the environment, then makes other people go, oh, why aren't we doing that? It's a free service. I think there is a lot of work for all of us as brewers to do to get to that stage. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, maybe, Ben, about any specific kind of techniques you've brought in the brew house or in the brewery to kind of improve your impact on the planet that have been like a decisive thing that you've brought in.
Sound really daft and a small one, but even something as small as like a flow meter. So looking at yields that will, from a sort of sustainable point of view, we're getting more out of the raw materials that we're using before we're incredibly inefficient on certain things as well. We've looked, saying a lot of stuff that we're putting into place. So particularly of our energy, solar will be the next move that we want to do. But our long-term plan is to be carbon neutral or carbon negative. And we're very fortunate that we have space to do it. We can plant trees, we can plant hedgerows, and we can sort of plant them ourselves on the farm, which is really, really important. And then even looking super long-term, we're starting a sort of mixed firm program in the new year. The long-term plan around that is actually that we're going to grow our own fruit on the farm to put into our own barrels, picked by ourselves. So in essence, well, not completely sort of net zero, but as close as we can get to it. But I think a lot of this is, we're fortunate of our space, we're fortunate of our size, but we also have quite a clear goal on what size we want to be. We're at about now 2,000 hectolitres, we'll be about 2,500 next year. We have the mixed firm a little bit over that, but there's no plans to be a 5,000 hec or 10,000 hec. And I think, but no offence to those guys who want to go bigger and stuff, but that's putting a lot more strain on what you're doing. We also, in terms of our footprint, the tap rooms helped massively. This year we're at about 28% direct through our tap room. Our tap room is 10 metres away from where it's made, so there's absolutely no vans taken to do that. It's just sort of rolled across the courtyard, put into the cellar. I think that's allowed us to take quite a lot of pressure off. And we were all talking earlier about how the scene's become a bit more localised. I mean, we sell between our tap room and the local area, like sort of Manchester, Preston, Wigan, we sell about 80% of our beer. We're then selling about another 5%, say, to sort of Leeds and Yorkshire. Roughly another 5% in the UK then. And like, being honest, we sell a little bit abroad as well. But everything is road freight, nothing's air freight in terms of sending it over. And I think that localised, selling locally is having a decent impact. And we're seeing it more and more with the bars in the area where they are stocking predominantly sort of 80% of the lines are by breweries from their area. And I like that as a model. I like that, you know, I'm down in London next week. I want to try breweries in London that I don't see in the north, or ones I've not even heard of, and the same sort of going to Bristol or going up to Edinburgh and stuff.
Yeah, one of the things that I find so interesting and difficult about this topic, and that kind of goes into the topic we did yesterday about the cost of living crisis, is, yeah, a lot of these things are expensive, but there's so much wrapped up in contradicting things about the industry. So, for example, air freighting keeps the beer good. We all want good beer. However, it's not great for the environment. Breweries are encouraged, especially if you're making hoppy beers, that you have cold storage. That's a lot of energy. And then further to that, to make the beers that people want to drink, and I'm going to talk to both of you guys because you both make very hoppy beers, those hops are coming often from New Zealand and America, North America. And I think there's some really cool things happening with development in technology. So, for example, things that might have been shunned or looked down upon a few years ago, such as using extracts or essences or liquid hops, were kind of like, oh, that's not very traditional. But now if you think about the way people are moving forward, they're processing the hops in America into like a liquid form that then you can use essentially 20 kilos of hops, and all they've extracted all the good things you're looking for at the source. And I think that is for the future of being able to use those hops in a sustainable way, because people aren't going to stop using hops from those countries until we can grow ones that are as good here. Chris, you guys are, I assume, planning to make quite a lot of hoppy beers. Is that something that you guys consider?
Yeah, I mean, it's a conversation kind of that Ethan and I is in front of us now. I've already started talking about that, and kind of Sam, our head brewer, of, you know, there's styles that we can just use all English ingredients, and I think that's really important to highlight that. You know, and you know, whether it's an all English lager or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think we can do our bit there to kind of make sure we're going down that route. Ethan and I have been having great chats on the kind of supply chain, and actually, as good things, we didn't get that far with that. We were very much kind of focused on the energy consumption, water, the treatment on site. You know, I invented a spent grain dehydrator, so we could take all our spent grain and turn it into flour on site. We had an on-site flour mill, you know, and kind of use that in pizza and on our site and kind of in local bakeries, etc. So I think there's many elements of the supply chain now that we're really excited to look into. But yeah, as you say, we were using hop oils right at the end. We actually had a beer in tank that we were going to release and just not tell anyone. It was Kiss the Ground, one of our IPAs, a really popular IPA of ours. It had been a really successful beer for us, so we thought we'd replicate it using only hop oils. And like, as compared, that was quite new. It was like, it's 2 years ago, and for us it was very new, so we hadn't really got into that process, you know, too far down the line, but it was tasting really good and we were really interested to release it. Sadly, it's one of the ones that was in the fire and sort of helped put the fire out rather than get released to our customers. But yeah, I think there's so much interest in that side. Some of our brew team from Good Things have actually gone into that kind of realm of work, into hop oils, working with Totally Natural Solutions. And I think there's more and more, from what I understand, with Bath and YCH coming into the game.
I think we've used Spectrum a little bit, which is like liquid hop before, but one of the biggest ones is even cryo. So cryo or CGX or Lupamax, in essence, we see it as half the amount of T90 that we'd use. So even this year, we've probably cut the amount of T90s we use by about half a ton just by using more cryo. And one of the good things is win all round. So we're putting less hops in, still getting the same aroma. We're getting better yields. It's allowed us to actually lower our prices in certain cases, well, some of our beers, and it's managed to allow us to offset some of the on costs with electricity and grain and yeast and everything that's going up in price. But yeah, it's been huge. I mean, look, we contract 3.8 tons or so, and we've managed to drop half a ton of that just by focusing a bit more on CGX, Lupamax, and Cryo. And again, on our scale, if you look at the bigger boys, and I think all the main guys have seemed to be using sort of Cryo and CGX and stuff now as well.
I've also not looked into or even seen the research, but I assume the shelf life of these things is significantly better than having contract hops in pellet form.
Yeah.
So I think the irony of these kind of things is that I've always struggled with, being someone who has a degree in chemistry and kind of almost went into working in pharmaceuticals, but also loves drinking, you know, natural wine and all that, is there's this kind of idea that technology and chemistry and science is a bad thing, and that beer should be 100% natural. And obviously that is ideal, but people don't realize that sometimes that a lot of these intensive, quite intense processes to turn what is essentially a flower that's on a field in, you know, Northern America, and take that and then do a lot of chemistry to get that into a form. However, and people sometimes look at that and go, like, that's not craft beer. I used to do that. I used to be so against adding anything, finings. And then whenever you realize that by finding a beer, for example, you're increasing the yield, that's less beer going down the drain. Where do people think that those per yield beers go? They go down the drain, they go into effluent. You know, it's, I think we need to maybe be a little bit more okay with using the technology that's out there.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it's the point that we found in terms of what you're saying. I think yields is massive because it's a win for the consumer as well. And that's something that's missed at times, is that a lot of these products coming through, not only are they good environmentally for sort of decreasing what we're using, you know, us putting 5 kilos of cryo in versus 10 kilos of T90, as we've seen from our tests, there's no detriment whatsoever to the beer that we're producing. I hope, unless anyone can tell me different. But it's allowed us, yeah, you know, we might be getting 50, 70, 80 litres more, which is 3 kegs more, versus a beer that we've costed at a certain price based on the yield we were getting. So all the way back up the supply chain in terms of selling to bars, the bar being able to sell it to the consumers, and in an era of like a cost of living crisis, it's sort of, I think yields are sort of massive in terms of helping sustainability.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's broadly one of the points that I would make is that, I mean, essentially, like, I want to make the point that Indie Brand's not a brewer. And we don't want to be out here, like, preaching and telling brewers how they should or shouldn't be making beer. Like, we just see our role as kind of being part of the conversation and, like, triggering a bit of conversation. And even just the air freight thing allowed us to start a bit of a conversation. Because we have a foot in both camps, really. You know, we're really good friends with the brewers, but we're essentially a consumer-facing event, you know. So we want to have that channel talking directly to the consumer. And, you know, whether we like it or not, whether you're into sustainability or not, it is becoming an increasing part of the conversation for consumers. It's going to be more and more of a thing that there's an expectation there from consumers that there will be some consideration given to environmental concerns within the stuff that they're buying, whether that's clothing or beer or wine or whatever. It's going to become an increasing part of the conversation. And whether that becomes part of the, you know, picture for carbon taxes and various other things. So there's a kind of idealistic side of it. It's like, we all think this is the best way forward and we think this is a good idea and stuff that we should be doing. But equally, the world is going to catch up eventually, current government permitting. But it will happen. That is the direction of travel. So everyone's going to have to be doing this, and it will become a basic expectation. But there's a real benefit in being a sort of early adopter, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most key points is all these, especially, as you said, in the cost of living crisis, no one, no matter how good their intentions is as a company, is going to make changes for the benefit of the environment that's going to cost them money and put the business at risk. So yeah, it has to be beneficial, be that through grants or, you know, laws that make people have to force the way they change. One thing I want to talk about, which is a positive thing, is the kind of one of the things I've found from brewing recently at New Barns is that certain things that maybe wouldn't have been cool a decade ago are now cool. So we sell a lot of lagers made with heritage grain, and that's kind of something that I've never heard people talk about 5-10 years ago. And now we've got breweries like Ideal Day down in Cornwall who are working with farmers doing things with regenerative farming. And Ben, you talked a little bit about the way in which grain is, barley is farmed and how detrimental that can be. Have you looked into any kind of regenerative methods, or is that something you already look at?
So in terms, we've actually looked, there's a local distillery near us who planted their own barley as well. So we actually looked at trying to use it from those guys. The issue was, it is so wet where we are that the actual crop was awful. But yeah, in terms of regenerative, we've not fully chatted a lot with Crisp on it yet, but it's the it's the impact that monocropping has, that you're sort of planting something in and we're saying it's sort of been turned over 5, 6, 7, 8 times a year, taking all the nutrients out of the sort of the grass. So the idea is regenerative, to sort of give it a rest, move on to another field, move something like cattle on, sort of bring nutrient back into the soil and sort of like give the land a rest. I mean, there's talk of a place in sort of America where they reckon there's only like 10, 15 harvests left on pieces of land because it's just been monocrops and been absolutely stripped of all nutrients and all goodness. So, in terms of, we have sort of talked with Mike a little bit and seeing what they're doing. But I think all the grain suppliers are starting to sort of realise the impact that they have as well and what they also need to do. But sadly and ultimately, I think for a lot of businesses, it will also come down to price. My sort of said my previous job, I dealt with supermarkets doing sales for a couple of different companies. And that conversation is never about, well, I don't know if it's changed. I've been out for like 10 years, but it was always about price. It was never about consumer necessarily even want or need. It came to that decision on that product. Okay, if that thing that's better for the environment is 10p more, who's going to pay for it? And the supplier didn't want to, and the supermarket didn't want to, because they basically don't want to pass the price on to the consumer. So I think a lot of this is going to have to be pressure up from breweries to suppliers to say, okay, what are you doing with your land? How are you looking after your land? And I think if we always look at America as being 20 years ahead of the UK in terms of things, there's so many sort of local small-scale maltsters there. In essence, I mean, our Chris Malt comes from Norfolk. If anyone can grow it in the Northwest, let me know, because that'd be great. But
yeah, we're lucky where we are in Scotland. We're surrounded because of the distilling industry with Simpson's Crisp. We have a small maltster in in Fife called Crafty Maltsters. But looking back to what we just discussed yesterday, which was the cost of living crisis, the average price, just to go into, is so maybe for a ton of malt from someone like Crisp at the moment, correct me if I'm wrong, around, you know, 800-900 for a ton. Some of the prices of these malts that are come from smaller manufacturers are almost about, we paid £1,800 for a ton, which basically means we're making a lager, because once you start adding hops to that, it's just, you know, the price is going crazy. So yeah, we're in this really tough position as brewers to do good for the environment and the planet, but also, I mean, that's going to add an extra pound on to the per litre, and then people are going to be like, oh man, it's more expensive.
Yeah. And I think that's the hardest thing is, I'm not saying sort of people don't care, but ultimately when it comes down to money, basically, and especially cost of living crisis, you have a decision to pay for a beer that's already, look, craft beer is already very expensive anyway. Like, it's not always the most accessible at its price point. Suddenly if those pints become 50p more, a pound more, it is really tough. If we talk about the government earlier, like, government intervention will have to be one of those things as well. A lot of this is going to be pressure put on people who can make a significant amount of change. So, on our scale, as going carbon neutral, we will have a minuscule impact on terms of sort of the environment and what we do. Now, you know, the maltsters will have a bigger one, but then actually moving huge corporations to being sort of net zero, that's what's going to make the massive amount of change. I think it's going to come from like a lot of pressure from consumers, small suppliers, all the way up.
I think as Johnny touched on earlier about is communication and kind of the industry, the craft industry is a very collaborative industry. It always feels like, I mean, coming here for me as a punter for the last 7-8 years is it's always about that feeling, kind of everyone getting together. It's kind of it feels like this kind of in unison kind of motion. And it'd be great to have a platform, you know, I don't know if it can come from a brewery or, you know, whoever it may be, but, you know, a little bit like the conversations you sparked up for, you know, just in the decisions you made for this festival. It'd be good to have a platform and kind of put, there's some amazing minds upstairs, you know, and kind of in the brewing industry. And to have all of those minds together and talking about it in a really open way, and that being an open platform as well where consumers can consume that information, and kind of it would just be a really nice, okay, well, there will have to be some price change.
Yeah.
You know, that is inevitable, and that will happen with or without any push into kind of a sustainable direction.
I think that's a really good idea in terms of just even like the things people can basically bring into breweries. Like breweries talk about hop suppliers, malt suppliers, bars that owe us money, but actually we're not really sharing, like,
yeah,
okay, like you say, nearly the solar panel that you managed to get for 14k, we've had quotes for £70,000,
yeah,
like X installation. I had no idea you could get it for that cheap. So actually having like a platform to sort of share, yeah, that information would be mega.
And I'm sat here learning in a 40-minute chat, you know, and there's very, yeah, few of us compared to, you know, the amount of people that this festival and in the industry itself. And
like you said, there's also the, I think, well, look, small businesses won't realise is the access to grants and funding. Like we got an EU rural diversification grant to fund our brewery and our tap room, and I actually found about it from a guy who owns Bike Park Wales in South Wales, and they got £1 million grant. I was like, well, that's an incredible amount of money. He was like, no, he said, like a 10-mile stretch of motorway will get a £10 million grant. He's like, if you know that they're there, the grants, that money's there, councils want to spend it. But actually, big businesses will have whole teams just going after all the grants that are available to get that money in. Now, if there was a resource, a way of saying, right, you know, and once you build up that rapport, like we've had our council contacts a couple of times saying, you know, there's more grants going. It's often linked to employment. And with us being at max capacity, we can't really utilise it. But we could say, okay, actually, I know another brewery in Lancashire in a rural location who wants to do something similar. So actually, using that, I know Left Handed Giant have done quite a bit with sort of grant funding and CO2 recapture, all sorts.
Yeah, that's something that I think is really important. And people maybe don't realise that when brewers go to these sort of things, they aren't just standing around drinking. There is a lot of these discussions that happen because, you know, it's a lot of the time it is people have the knowledge and they're willing to share it. It's just they didn't know. I mean, for example, Daya, I think, have just installed a device for recapturing carbon dioxide. So, you know, all tanks, when they're fermenting or letting off gas, that just goes into the atmosphere, and then we go and buy in more CO2 to carbonate our beers. It seems crazy. There's companies out there now, I believe in Denmark, who are making an affordable carbon capture thing that is within the realms of a brewery of our size to get, because some of these things aren't accessible for us. I mean, one of the most amazing things happening in sustainability in beer at the moment is the work that Gypsy Hill have been doing. They've just made, I think it might be the world's first, or at least the UK's first, carbon negative beers. And the way they're doing that is they're taking their centrifuge, which is called the decanter centrifuge, which is basically very efficient and can produce the hops that are being kicked out of that, rather than being like a wet slurry or almost like a solid mass, that then they can take those hops and use them in another beer on the hot side. They're also, to make it more carbon neutral or negative, they use regenerative farming as well. But that decanter centrifuge, for example, is at least £250,000. But they're going to see that money back because they're a big enough brewery, but we're never buying that. But grants would definitely help that.
Well, it's the long-term payback as well. I think, ironically, one of the things with like the electricity going up in price is it forced, I know for us, we always wanted to install solar panels, but we were like, you know, there's all other little bits, you know, bar breweries being hit by lightning. Breweries always have things that break and stuff all the time and need improving. So like one day we'll get to the point we can do solar. Suddenly when our kilowatt rate has almost doubled, actually the payback on solar panels will be 3 years rather than 8 years. And that was at the quote that we had. So if that quote's even lower, then again, if we're using less electricity, we, you know, cost all the use of power into every beer we make. If that's been decreased and we pay back our solar, again, it can allow us to sort of make beer cheaper. Gypsy Hill, sort of reusing it, it's going to make their beer cheap in the long term as well, if you sort of pass those savings on.
There's another thing that we're going to be doing at the brewery with for the solar side, to kind of decrease the amount of panels you need to run a brewery. Breweries take a lot of energy. Kind of that was the start of this process for us, was, or for myself, was a lot of research. You need to talk about like the carbon footprint of one beer to 98 trees, 2 days to take it away again. And it's a stat from kind of loads of information fed in, but the point was, it is quite destructive.
Yeah.
But one of the things that kind of we've looked at is utilising things like, so EV cars now, so electric vehicles out there, they have a run life of batteries that isn't that long, like 6-7 years at a high performance, but yet when it's done out of that car, all the other side is written off, but probably not as nice conversation to have. When it's done in that car, it still has so much use and so much energy. Three batteries from kind of the higher range Teslas, once they're kind of 6-7 years out, you could run in our brewery off of 3 old batteries. And kind of putting that information out there and talking about that, that then means less solar panels, it's less installation, so on and so forth. And you're picking them up from anywhere between kind of 12 and 17 grand. But you're talking about each one being 75 kilowatts in energy, which is awesome. So it's something that we'll be putting in and we'll be talking about quite a lot and, you know, quite openly. It's a bit of a trial, but I mean, it's been done before in many other ways. It's just the batteries used to be 250, 300 grand, you know, just to achieve what we needed as a really small, you know, 25 hec, 8 tank brewery. Yeah.
We could sit here all day and talk about, there was so much we've not covered, you know, effluent and all this sort of things, but we need to wrap it up. But we're going to take some questions. So if anyone's got any questions.
I have a question, Johnny, for the panel.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi there, big fan. There's a brewery in Scotland that makes a very bold claim that their beer is carbon negative based on carbon offsetting rather than actual use of raw materials and how they power the brewery. There's a lot of talk about sustainability out there. How do we ensure that we are delivering an honest message to the consumer rather than sticking labels like B Corp on stuff? Like how do we ensure that what breweries are doing is genuine, honest, and what transparency should there be to those processes? And that's to all of the panel.
For me, it comes back to that communication side again. And there's something very powerful in a collective of as many UK brewers as we can possibly get in one space or on one platform, talking in one space. And that being then open to the public. I think when you've got giants such as, obviously no one knew who Matt was talking about then, but when you've got those people in the industry putting, you know, they can put a media piece that would cost £50,000 to put out that we're never going to do. So I think then the power is then in the collective kind of side of the industry.
I think the accountability as well. I think that's one of the things, almost the downside to social media is either A, feeling the pressure to do something, and B, like that brewery in Scotland did, we'll put this out there without even sort of implementing it. You know, it sounds like you guys are quite similar. We've often tried to do things for the right reason and not shout about it. Like a completely different tangent, we started doing a 4-day work week this year, and we've not shouted about it because it's just the right thing to do from sort of employee and everything on that. But it's, yeah, it's almost sort of, I think having the chats and not, you know, pinning a brewery down and saying you're not doing enough, but actually finding what will make it tick for them as well, you know, what will help. And it might be the commercial value, it might be sort of doing more to help the planet, but I think it's going to be quite a collective thing. And then you can pick out then the guys, and consumers will see the guys that really don't care.
I didn't actually know who you were talking about there, Matt. But I do know, like, quite widely, well, across all kinds of industries, there's lots of people who are kind of stealing a march on talking about net zero and carbon neutral. And I think, like, there's a big education piece out there because, you know, like, there's a lot of confusion about what the difference between net zero is and different terminology and carbon neutral. But I think BrewDog, like... Oh, shit, sorry. I think the you know, it's indicative of how they tend to sort of do strategy and stuff anyway, which is kind of on the hoof. However, they are pretty smart because they understand that this is a powerful, like, it's a powerful thing that they're dealing with, and they understand the power of it. I have equal frustrations. I also own Nell's Pizza in town, so we've done a lot of work on sustainability. And equally, we don't shout about it. We're not ready to shout about it because we don't really think we've done all the work. You know, we went 100% electric. We've got 100% renewable electricity. And, you know, we source locally wherever possible. But, you know, we're talking about our primary emissions, you know, like digging into your sort of secondary and tertiary emissions all the way down the supply chain is a huge amount of work for any, like, small business. Whereas, but you know, a nameless Scottish brewery can do it. But equally, you know, I had a similar feeling when there was a very well-known steak restaurant that started trumpeting their carbon neutrality and net zero qualifications when primarily they, you know, sell a lot of beef. Beef is a huge impact. So there's only one way that you can do that, which is through offsetting. And there's all kinds of horror stories about the quality of these offset programs, or complete lack of quality, quite possibly. So I think there's a broader kind of educational piece for the general public about what these terms mean, what the implications of offsetting were, are, and how genuine those claims are.
Can I ask, are consumers, when they're going into Nels or going into Common, are they asking much about your carbon footprint? Are they asking about certain breweries' sort of carbon footprint, or is that, are we nowhere near that yet?
No. I mean, for me, we're not there yet. And I think there is, you know, like I said, there's an element of, at the moment, we're working on it as much as a kind of, because it's the right thing to do, number one, but also it's an important part of our culture as an organisation. And it's an important internal message. Like, we have nearly 120 people on the books, and it's like, it's an important thing for us to get out there and to talk about with our teams, first of all. And then once we're really comfortable with it, we're doing the Sustainable Restaurant Association Food Made Good rating and everything. And we do want to be B Corp in the future, and we do want to do all this stuff. But it's, you know, it's a slow and steady process. And, you know, it's also about putting your head above the parapet as well, because if we're not 100% confident about what we're putting out there, then, you know, it's not a comfortable place to be. So.
I think, yeah, accountability is going to be what, and from the consumer, you know, I think what the changes that have happened in the industry in other regards has definitely come from people being like, how many, you know, how diverse is your brewery, for example? And then people go, oh shit, that's something we should take into consideration, not just because people are going to judge us for it, but because it's the right thing to do. Until people start holding breweries and other companies accountable and being like, asking the questions, like, I know it's not cool, rather than what hops are in this, being like, what's your yield on this batch? Like, it's the things that are, it's not very cool at the moment to talk about sustainability, but I also think it's, we have to be careful to not become too judgy, because it's very easy for me to say importing hops from the States is bad, but sometimes it only represents like a tiny percentage weight of the actual product. So if you're using malt that's grown locally and you're using water from a borehole and you've got your rates down to, you know, three liters per to one, then if you're ordering in like 10 kilo of hops, then maybe it's not the worst thing in the world, and maybe we shouldn't give people a hard time.
For sure. Like, if you're trying your best and you're doing something, I think that is the fear at times, is that, again, if you're a brewery in an industrial state that doesn't have a rural location like both we do, it's a lot harder, and there's almost the risk that with certain businesses they'd be discouraged from doing it. Like, we've tried to do our best, and yet we're shot down for not doing enough. So it could end up going completely the other way. So I think that's it. As long as people are making, like I said, slow and steady, make the changes you can while you can, but keep trying to make changes each year, then it will, yeah, hopefully come good.
Is there any more questions from the audience?
You've obviously talked about hops, you've talked about malt, I've not really touched on yeast, but you don't really need to, I suppose, in that sense. Do you think there will be a way, technically, chemistry-wise, whatever, to reduce your water consumption in beer?
Yes.
Yes.
Again, comes to scale. I mean, well, like an effluent point of view, guys like Northern Monk have to treat all of their water before it sort of goes back into the system. You'll know more in terms of reusing it or recapturing it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's many breweries already, even. The cleaning process in a brewery is huge, and it uses a lot of water. And I've seen kind of, you know, many processes from, you know, dry floor cleaning, you know, trying to reduce kind of the amount of water being pushed around that brewery. And we have a borehole, and again, yes, we can do that kind of where we are, and the water is suitable to be able to do it. So it kind of reduces our need to look too far into it, but. Kind of not everyone does, and you know, there are water issues. I mean, the area we're in, kind of near Tunbridge Wells, every year now just seems to run out of water, like not enough reservoirs and so forth. So I used to say, oh, is it really a problem, water? Like kind of looking at all the other energy, high energy impacts in a brewery, the water was like, that borehole is £27,000. How much beer have we got to sell to get £27,000 of profit back?
That's it's interesting because we're out passing the buck as well. Our local water supplier made, like local, a big one, £50-100 million profit last year, but they had 40% losses of water from their reservoirs because they're using reservoirs that are 250 years old. Leaks are going and stuff as well. So again, actually, us using a lot of water in an intensive process, if the pressure's on them to say, you know, instead of your shareholders, you need to reinvest 50 million into reducing that 40% down to 20%, we have a lot of water in the Northwest. So yeah, like there's bits like that around the water companies that could make huge differences.
I do think in general, kind of localized utilities is the answer. So kind of whether that's, if you're in a position like we may be, we've got a charity-led sort of climbing center next to us, gets kids out of kind of cities, and it's all free for those kids and free for those schools. You know, if we can, you know, we have a high output requirement or input requirement in a brewery for 3 hours, and then we've got a stack of energy that can be used. So then trying to work with like local communities of how you can help them with kind of their power sourcing and so on and so forth. I think that's the same with water. When you go out to reservoirs and then, as you just said, they've got problems of losing 40% of that water.
Yeah.
You know, when it's localized like a borehole, I guess that is the argument against it, but there's still kind of the statement I said of it's a lot of money.
Yeah. It's also like a very dated system. Although we're next to a reservoir, our water comes from the Lake District, as does Manchester's, and our reservoir actually goes to Liverpool. And then obviously there's villages in North Wales that were flooded for water for Liverpool, which is now not needed. So this is a whole system that's sort of 200, 250 years old, probably similar with a lot of the electricity system that's not actually catered to be yet on a, like a local basis and minimising that. And again, it will come down to investment or pressure on big companies to sort of restructure what they're doing.
Yeah, I think being in an area that is wet all the time, I've never really had to consider drought. So definitely times in the brewery where I've over-rinsed things because I'm distracted and it's never really a thing I need to think about. The only thing that made us think about it is at the end of every week we started writing down our meter readings just so we had a record, and then we just used the two sums, be like, how much did we make this week in terms of liters of beer? How much water did we use according to the meters? And then we work out the ratio and then we kind of plot that. So if I'm being honest, haven't done that in a while because we've been busy and that's how it goes. But yeah, there is ways, and it's really simple things like just when you're rinsing, just like a little test for caustic, little phenolphthalein thing to see if you've actually rinsed out your chemicals enough. But yeah, people have no idea how much water gets used just for rinsing in breweries. And unfortunately, at the smaller end of the scale, it tends to be more water than the big guys, just because the technology for automated cleaning and things is so expensive that, you know, often we're cleaning things by hand. But it is something that I think is one of the easier things to implement, and it's just as simple as just, you know, taking a note of those readings and trying to work towards a target. And yeah. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thanks for all the great questions. Mainly thanks to these guys. And yeah, have a lovely, lovely day.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Lovely stuff there. Thank you to our panelists. And we still have two more panel discussions from IndieMan, one about the cost of living crisis and another called The State of Craft Beer. Big discussion there. And they will be with you in a few weeks. But I'm trying something a little different. Rather than putting them all out together, which can be a bit fatiguing if they're on the same subject, I'm sort of mixing them in with the other things I've recorded. So the next episode, I'm hoping, will be this kind of state of the industry episode that I recorded at SIBA, the Society of Independent Brewers Beer X Conference, last month in Liverpool. And rather than having one long interview, it's about 8 or 9 short interviews with various people in the beer and brewing industry, and I asked them for one positive feeling about beer and one negative feeling about beer. So I'm going to try and cut those together. I'm not sure if it's going to work, to be honest, but hey, it's my podcast. It's worth a try, and I hope you enjoy it when I do eventually put it out in a few weeks' time. If you've been enjoying these podcasts, and indeed what we put out on pellicklemag.com, do consider becoming a subscriber. For just £4 a month, or even £1 a month, if £4 is a bit too much, you can help us support the writers, photographers, and illustrators that we pay week in, week out to produce the content you love reading. And in a little way, you also support this podcast. But the easiest way to support this podcast is by subscribing in the app you're in now, leaving us a little rating, and then telling people about us. Anyway, that's all my spiel for this week. I'll be back with another episode in a couple of weeks. I've been Matthew Curtis. You have been listening to the Pellicle Podcast, and I will see you very soon.